A.W. Masters, reel 19.
And then it became known that we was going to, as we thought, Singapore, which we did. But we're not a long way past Singapore. You see, with our first minefield, the actual minefield was off the Dutch East Indies, the Anambra Islands. Mm. And then when we thought we'd finished that, it was, oh, blimey, yeah, Singapore now home. No. Went back to Singapore, yes. Get her ready for South. Oh, South, where? Australia. Blimey. Well, of course, I mean, the ships we were in, they were only tiny things, coal burners at that, and no arrangements for tropics. You had simply lived on the upper deck, and that's where you had to stop. And as I say, when we got down there, through the Great Barrier Reef, it was a wonderful experience and all that sort of thing, but when we got down to Sydney, we'd gone through the first South Pacific gale. I mean, things weren't at all pleasant, but anyway, having arrived there, New Zealand. We got over to Wellington, go down to Westport to coal, back north then, to the north of the North Island. Yes. Then stopped at a place called Chatham, in Auckland, that was. One of the harbours in, and another one is Devonport. Both in Auckland, there. As I thought, a man was pulling my leg. I said, what's the name of the anchorage? He said, Chatham, a good air of this. He said, that's true, it's Chatham. He said, that's Devonport. Oh, but anyway, then of course we went back to Sydney, thinking we finished the whole thing. No. More mines now down south. So away we went again, down to the Bass Straits, north of Tasmania, off a place called Eden. The actual geographical point there was Twofold Bay, and had another minefield to sweep there. Had to run off it about four times, the big seas, too heavy to sweep. Anyway, eventually made the most of it, got back, and then back to Sydney, and now we're finished. When we arrived at Sydney, we were 23 hands short in the three ships, asked for the Australian Navy for volunteers.
These men, what had happened to them?
Either died or been killed or what have you. They've all gone anyway, 23 of them. Gone mad, four of them. Literally mad, out with a tropical sun. And of course, I mean, the type of man you was getting, they were wartime people, you see. I'm not belittling them then anyway, but they weren't the same type. And when we got, as I say, we got to Sydney 23 short, asked the Australian Navy for volunteers. We had one volunteer. He was a petty officer nobody wanted, so I said, right, we won't have any. So the Australian Navy didn't touch it at all. And then they left these ships out there because they weren't worth bringing home, you see. They were only wartime-built sloops. And the Australian Navy never did take them to sea, I don't think. They eventually sunk them out there.
They were sunk, yeah. You said there about people in the war that, who joined the Navy. What sort of people who joined for the duration of the war? Were they different in that way?
Well, only of course, that they lacked our experience of discipline. But they were as willing. Oh, God, they were salty as sea, they were. The majority, I mean, what they lacked in experience, they made up for in trying.
Enthusiasm. And
yes, definitely. Yes.
People didn't complain about them?
Not at all. There was no complaint. No.
Did they actually make any impression on the Navy, people like that, in terms of, say, being used to shore life and coming into the Navy a bit older than the average sailor, with a bit more awareness of social life ashore?
No.
Trade union activity and so on, which wasn't that developed then.
There wasn't any trade union activity in those days.
And it didn't come in.
No.
With then.
No.
In what ways did, I mean, you were actually on foreign station when war was declared,
in Malta.
Can you remember what your reactions to war were at that time, or what you felt?
I don't think there was anything extraordinary. The preparations were made. We started making preparations about a fortnight beforehand, getting ready.
Yes.
And nobody knew why or what to do, didn't know what to expect, you see. And the whole object was, the German Navy are going to start, well, let's get out there and get at them.
People were quite...
Oh, enthusiastic.
Enthusiastic and keen.
Now, Ludovic Kennedy, his father was captain of a ship out there, and on the 2nd of August, 14, this particular Sunday it was, I think it was a Sunday, anyway, she was getting ready to go to sea, the Indomitable he was in, the old battle cruiser, and they recalled all the Liberty men, and on her mast, every available pair of halyards carried the recall flag. I'll never forget it. She was a really dressed ship. She had about 17 flags flying. But anyway, all the men came back with no hesitation from leave in Malta. Mm-hmm. And we'd sailed at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. We were the first ship to leave.
Was the Navy, you say there that you started getting ready for this 2 weeks before the outbreak of war. I mean, you had a feeling somebody knew something.
Somebody knew.
Yes. In a sense, how well prepared was the Navy at your level, at the level of workmanship and general...
Everything ready, everything cut and dried.
It was ready, was
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, yes.
Was
yes.
It such a big shift into war routine then?
No.
It wasn't.
We did things then which, of course, had been handed down from the old sailor Navy, such as putting splinter mats around their superstructure, and even hammocks were taken up and lashed around the exposed positions. With the object, of course, of prevent, as the name implies, prevent splinters flying. But that just wasn't required. It didn't have any results. But the point was, there was always enthusiasm there. And as I say, when the daybreak of the 4th of August came, we found ourselves early morning on the western end of the Straits of Messina. We was going through at about 18 or 20 knots, which was quite some speed for a ship of those days. And it was then made known, of course there were no broadcast systems or anything of that in those days, but it became known in the ship that our quarry was the Goeben and Breslau. Unfortunately for us, they'd gone. When I say fortunately, I mean we were in no position ever to tackle the Goeben. 11-inch guns, of course you'd have blown us clean out of the water. But anyway, when we got out of the eastern end, we were informed by the officials in Messina that these two ships had been through so many hours previous, and they were heading in the easterly direction. It became obvious then, even to the numbskull, that they were making for the Dardanelles, to Turkey, you see, to get out of it. And we majestically gave chase, and all we saw was a blue sea for about 4 hours, and then we were recalled to Malta to Cole. And of course the Admiral, who was in charge of the Mediterranean fleet in those days, he had the reputation of being, don't say pro-German, but he definitely was in sympathy.
Who's that?
What the devil was his name? Boyd Hamilton? Yeah, Boyd Hamilton, I think it was. Of course, there's many men, well, naturally, 1914, a couple of days ago. But we were recalled to Malta. You see, and after we'd taken in an upper deck cargo of coal, we filled up with coal and then took in an upper deck cargo. And then we were ordered to go east to the Dardanelles. Went up through the Greek archipelago, which, of course, in the time we'd been out there, was common ground to us. And when we got there, she disappeared. She'd gone inside. And it wasn't long before we got orders to proceed to Portside, Suez Canal, East Africa, after the Konigsberg, you see. And, of course, when that debacle finished, well, we couldn't get up the river, you see, even a ship of that size, because she was a much lighter thing than us, and she'd gone up. We saw her mast, an open fire of 6-inch, over the top of the palms. And then, of course, they did all sorts of funny things, which I suppose anybody in the light position would have done. They landed guns and they fortified the entrance of the river. And we mined the entrance of the river.
Did you?
Mm. You never believe this. This is true, perfectly. Got a large lighter out of Mombasa and they got some of those big 25-gallon oil drums. Painted them a brilliant red, put them on this lighter and let it be known amongst the natives they were full of explosive mines. So with much majesty, they towed this lighter away on a long tow down to the entrance of the refuge. Somebody at night time, they went up and put an axe through the end of each drum, see? When it came daylight, towed this thing across the channel, dropping these things like that, you know, one at a time. Let it be known that it was mined. Empty oil drums. But it did its job, it stopped her coming out. She never attempted to come out anymore, as they landed her guns, you see. And whether we'd hit her with a 6-inch or not, we never knew. Never did know, but still. She didn't come out. And of course that corresponded with the sinking of the Emden. You see, the Emden was sunk at the Cocos Islands by the Sydney. The Sydney and Chatham were sister ships in the British Navy. The Emden and Konigsberg were sister ships in the German Navy. And these two was destroyed by the other two. There was Captain, what was his name, Glossop, was in the Sydney. And our captain was Drury Lowe, and they'd been midshipmen together. The whole thing sort of paired up, you know, as you went. But
there were other sloops there doing the mine laying besides yourselves. Were you the only ship?
No sloops. There were no sloops there. No, I was in the Chatham.
Chatham?
No, we was the only ship there.
You were the only one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We'd gone down from the Dardanelles, as I just said. There was no other ships there.
And you were in charge of the mine laying, were you at that time?
No. Oh, Lord, no. Well, because there were no mines there. There were only these drums.
No, this is the drum. I mean, who actually devised this operation?
I think it was our captain. I wouldn't be sure who was the actual thinker up of it. It might have been the commander who was there. He was a very nifty lad. But, what the devil was his name now? Fitzmaurice, yeah. Fitzmaurice was there then. But we went down to what was then German East Africa, down to Tanga. And we had three people, three killed there with fire from the beach, you know, the German forces, wherever they were. As I say, that is, well, of course, comes out of the dim mists of the past. At the same time, as far as I personally am concerned, you know, it's very nice to be able to look back on that time ago.
Did you find when you, or either today or when you left the Navy, that you missed the Navy in certain ways, that there were some things about the Navy life that...
Well, the Navy life is a thing that you never forget. You see, the first thing that you do miss is the comradeship. You don't meet the same type of man in civil life anymore. Well, neither would they in the Navy today. They haven't got that type of man at all. Because, as we've said a dozen times, owing to the closeness of the communal life, you knew everybody, everybody knew you, and your life was with others. And you grew up to know everybody. And it became absolutely a personal thing. Well, the same thing as you went on in life, you knew officers you'd grown up with, and when you come out, of course, you lose a lot. I mean, I've met commanders and captains and all sorts of people since. In the station one day, and I saw an old boy standing there waiting at the booking office. Now he looked at me a bit old-fashioned, and he said, "Good morning." I said, "Good morning, sir." I said, "I've just realised who you are." He was a vice admiral. So he said, "You was in the Sussex." I said, "That's right, sir, many years ago." He said, "I was in London." I said, "I know you was." I said, "You was Admiral of the first Cruiser Squadron." "Oh, yes," he said, "yes. And your captain then was, let me think," and he told me his name. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, it's nice seeing you down here." I said, "You're not living in Eastbourne, are you?" He said, "My family are." You know, I mean, you get that sort of thing, you see, and... Even, well, people you haven't seen for years and years, it's a common handshake. Mm-hmm. You know, your old chips and that's it. It's a wonderful feeling.
That doesn't exist among shore people at all. Did you find it difficult to adjust to shore life?
No, you didn't
find that a problem?
No. Well, I mean, after all, you realise you're in a different sphere. You've got to make do with it, you see. I mean, there's nothing wonderful about the Navy life, except it's a thing you can't explain. You know, I mean, the people who've never experienced it can't sort of see it naturally as we can. Well, it's very nice
Kelly.
Having met you.